and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. Our aim is to help you own your experience. I'm Hayley Manning, and today it's just going to be me. Unfortunately, Catherine can't be here today, but she'll be back as soon as she can. So today we're joined by Jane Fisher from ARC and Sally Kelly, our resident specialist midwife, as we have duly dubbed her. And a few of our listeners are going to be joining us in person to talk about the early days and weeks after a TFMR. Emotions are often confusing and conflicting. Our bodies are doing strange and sometimes scary things. And there are still yet more decisions to make, to do a funeral or not, to have a postmortem or not, etc. So we're dedicating this episode to talking about this, and we're really pleased to be able to have all of our guests here with us today. So welcome, first of all, to Jane and Sally. Thank you very much for joining us and having you here as our expert guests. No pressure.
Thanks for the pressure. Yes, it does feel a bit pressure.
No, I know that you will answer the questions as best you can. Yeah. So we're going to jump straight in, really, with our first listener, Lucy. Lucy, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
Lovely having you here. So go for it.
Hi. It's really nice to meet everybody. My first question is, making decisions when we're in a state of grief and shock is incredibly difficult. Is there a pathway or guidelines for this? And are healthcare professionals working towards a protocol? From my experience, when you are first told that you may have to make the decision to make a TFMR, it would be really good to see what the pathway is, because afterwards and later down the line, I found out so much information from other people who'd gone through that experience, and all the medical jargon, all the different options that are available, what different terminations meant. So it'd be really useful to see something, a guideway to kind of navigate yourself through the experience, just because to make a decision when you're in a state of shock is so difficult.
Good question. I don't, Sally, maybe it's better for you to start from the health professional point of view and then I'll chip in.
Okay. Yeah, no problems. So we do have information that's available, but as you quite rightly say, it's very hard in those moments to be even hearing what somebody else is saying to you. However, it sometimes needs to happen fairly quickly, but where there's time, that should always be allowed. And certainly we try our hardest in our trust to make sure that people have got time to think about their options so that they can ask questions, so they can go away, have a think. There shouldn't really be massive pressure on a person to make those decisions. Things are written down, and we now, a lot of the hospitals in the UK are following the National Bereavement Care Pathway. And this has a specific section just for this particular topic and group of parents, because it is hugely charged with emotions and trying to support people. But I have to say, there's a lot of information to impart at the time to help people to know which direction to think about or what they need to think about. And that can be really quite hard, because if you don't tell somebody something, I think that there's a danger always that that person could come back and say, well, I didn't know that we could have done this, or we could have done that, or there were different options. And I think that sometimes it depends who is imparting that information to you, because not everybody finds it, I wouldn't say the word is easy at all, but easier to explain what somebody's options are. I mean, does that help at all?
Yeah, that is helpful. But also it would be useful to know what to expect in terms of what support is available in terms of the hospital, and also the actual guidelines, because afterwards I realised I wasn't told so much information, which may have influenced me making a different decision. And because I didn't have that information, then I couldn't make an informed choice.
I'll maybe chip in there if I may, because we kind of know that Sally and her trust will be really well set up because Sally's there. And I think what we find is that there are trusts that do a really great job in coordinating the care for women and couples going through termination. There are other trusts that don't. And yes, we now have the National Bereavement Care Pathway for termination after a prenatal diagnosis, which we're really happy is there and being taken up, but it's not mandated. So it's really down to trusts wanting to pick it up and run with it and having somebody who will do the job, who will champion it. And that isn't always possible in certain trusts with the resource issues they have. So it's a challenge. And I think one of the things we're keen to do with the partner charities around the bereavement care pathway is try to make sure that the CQC know about it and actually make it part of their inspections, that bereavement care is really high quality and well coordinated. So that might make a difference.
Jane, can you just explain what the CQC is or what that stands for?
Sorry, the Care Quality Commission, the body that inspects hospitals and checks the standards of care. Because really, we've got to try and embed the National Bereavement Care Pathway in all trusts rather than rely on the incredible, going the extra mile of a handful of health professionals in particular trusts. Everybody needs to take this on because, as you say, Lucy, women and couples, when they're confronted with the prospect of TFMR, are in a state of crisis, trauma and shock, and they need somebody to really help guide them and give them that time and space to make decisions. And importantly, to contain them, because the acuteness of the distress can be such that it's very difficult to think about anything when you're in high and acute emotional distress. So a trained professional, it's something I think we're able to do on the ARC helpline, is manage that kind of situation, be calm and help people work through some of the decisions they face.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is that it needs to become part of our culture, really, that we hold bereavement care as something that's necessary and important, that it can't just be down to the Sallys of the world that are in the odd hospital here and there to carry all of this, because they are only one person. And even within their own hospitals, you know, they can't be expected to carry all of it. It needs to be really championed by all. And I'm very aware that we're talking about it from a UK perspective, and we have US listeners. And I mean, I have to admit, I have no idea what sort of care is there in the US. And I imagine, you know, they don't have a national health service. So this is right down to individual states and maybe down to individual hospitals, even more so than it may be here in the UK. So that is tricky. You know, we hear a lot from our US listeners that they have to do a lot of digging to find any kind of support. Lucy, would you like to come back in and say something? Yeah.
I just want to say as well, like, most of my information actually came from ARC and speaking to ARC every day during my decision-making process and also the podcast. But that shouldn't be relied on to get the information from not medical services. You need that information from the hospital, and it's really great all the other services that are helping, but it's really fundamental that you can get that information.
Yeah, I think it says a lot, doesn't it, Lucy, that, you know, the information is here from non-medical, you know, non-hospital, you know, the support and information is coming from the outside because there's a lack within some, you know, hospital trusts. So it's a gap that we're sort of filling, but you're right. You know, should that be a gap that needs to be filled? Yeah, begs that question.
Yeah.
Jane, I was just wondering if you have any information for our US listeners about who they can access there.
Yes, well, my first comment would be, I really feel for you because obviously things vary hugely from state to state in the US. Mm. And for some women, it's actually a real struggle to access the termination in the first place.
Yeah.
They may need to travel thousands of miles in some instances to actually get access care, which adds another layer. Of resources for women, the one that we know best is a website called Ending a Wanted Pregnancy, run by women who have been through this experience, and very well run, I have to say. It's a very thoughtful website, and if people are looking for that kind of online forum support, I'd advise giving them a look.
Okay. That's great. Thanks, Sally. And thanks, Jane, as well. Right, we're going to move on to our next question. And thank you, Lucy, for your very first question and getting us started.
Thank you.
So our next listener is Callie. And Callie is also joining us from the UK. Yeah, so Callie, would you like to go ahead and ask your question?
Hi, absolutely. I just want to echo what Lucy said about how amazingly helpful the podcast and ARC were for me. We've just had our second TFMR a few months ago, and the sort of emotional support was something that was really provided more by sort of the podcast and the third sector kind of charities. So thank you so much for that. But my question is more about genetic testing. We are currently waiting for our genetic testing results. And I was just wondering if you could provide some insight about whether there's a protocol surrounding asking for genetic testing. Is it something I should have asked for or been offered after my first TFMR? Or is it something that only gets offered to those who have experienced multiple losses?
Thanks, Kelly. Can I just clarify something with the question? So when you're talking about genetic testing, really that's to establish whether you and your partner actually carry something that may have influenced the diagnosis. Is that right?
Yes. So potentially whether we're carriers or there's something that may impact on future pregnancies going forward.
Yeah, so maybe we could start. Sally, do you want to start with that? And then Jane, you can come in and add where you need to.
Okay. So in terms of genetic counselling, some of our families, with the first time that they meet something like this, babies will often go for a post-mortem. And if the parents have agreed, then there'll be a genetic test done on the baby to see if there's anything very obvious. Sometimes these conditions, in most cases, can be one-offs. So it's nothing to do with the parents at all. But occasionally when families find that another pregnancy is affected, then questions start to be asked and people can look for more specific genes. That will only happen if it's the recommendation of the pathologist, if a postmortem has been taken, or if the geneticist, where you can go and have genetic counselling, has been advised to speak to you. And they quite often say, well, we know this much more about it, and it could be that you need just to check that neither of you are carriers of a certain thing. But of course, I think what's really hard is that genetics itself is very, very complex, and we only know a minuscule amount of the genetic information. So we don't always get an answer that says, yes, this is genetic, or no, it's not genetic, because you've got to know what it is you're looking for. And that isn't something that every single condition that children can have. It's not all been mapped yet. So for some cases, it could be that somebody has more than one child with a similar condition. It is very difficult. And sometimes that first pregnancy, you'll have a basic genetic test done if you have a postmortem, but it might not be looking for absolute specifics unless the doctors already suspect that there's a genetic element to it. Does that make any sense?
Yes, that's really helpful, yes.
Jane, is there anything you'd like to add to that? Thank you, Sally.
Yeah, thank you, Sally, and particularly thank you for making the point that although we've moved on incredibly in recent years in relation to genetic testing, so we've moved to really sensitive testing where we can now sequence the whole fetal genome, but we haven't moved that further on in actually being able to find the genetic components of all sorts of conditions. So we're at the tip of an iceberg, and it's really important to manage people's expectations around that. And so many couples will never find, doctors can suspect there may be a genetic component to what's been diagnosed, but they'll never find out or get an answer, which is incredibly frustrating. And to echo the point that the vast majority of prenatal diagnoses will be a one-off. And that can feel difficult in itself, I think, because, again, you don't have an answer to what was a random event. Mm-hmm. And it's a good question for any bereaved parent to ask of their consultant. What is the likelihood of this happening again? Do we need to see a genetic counsellor in order to assess the chances of this happening again? And fetal medicine specialists, etc., will have a good understanding of those conditions. They can be fairly confident are one-offs, and those where it may benefit in further investigations. And one last thing I wanted to say, because we've come across this recently, there is clearly a huge backlog in pathology and pathology labs at the moment, and genetic labs, in providing information from postmortems and genetic testing. So sadly, women and couples are facing horrendous waits for information, which obviously is awful, but I don't think there's anything they can do. It's partly COVID, partly staffing, etc., but the waits are terrible. And again, I think an awful lot of clinicians would say, when there isn't an intimation that it is a genetic condition, then for those couples who are often very desperate to start trying to conceive again, I don't think anyone clinical would say don't. Mm-hmm. They would say, if it feels right to you to start to try again, go for it, because it's very unlikely that anything that comes out of those investigations will say to you, you cannot have a baby.
Exactly.
Yeah. Melanie, did you want to come in and say something along this line? So Melanie is another listener that's going to be joining us, and she's got something she wants to add to this.
Yes. So thank you so much for having me. And regarding Callie's question, it was so shocking for me after my experience that it wasn't the standard of care all over the world. I'm located in New York in the US, that a genetic counselor was part of the prenatal process, like a fundamental part that starting at your 10-week appointment, you would go in and they would do your carrier testing. So I thought that everywhere, which is not the case, they would start out with the mom and you would go through testing to see if you're a carrier of anything. And then if you were a carrier of something, then they would test your partner. And then if you matched as a carrier of the same thing, then they would do further testing, either a CVS or an amnio, to test your baby to see if they had it. I wish I had that information on carrier testing prior to my TFMR pregnancy, because that information was so critical for making informed decisions for our family planning. As it turns out that my husband and I that have been together 9 years, we are both carriers for SMA, spinal muscular atrophy. And so we run the risk of every single natural pregnancy. It's a 25% chance that our child will have a fatal disease. So we've ended up going to IVF to ensure that that won't happen again. And we did a postmortem and it confirmed the diagnosis as well. But I thought that that carrier testing was everywhere.
Yeah.
And I wish that there was legislation everywhere that would say, you know, your pediatrician could run this test. It doesn't even have to be a blood test, but it could be a saliva test that could tell you whether you're a carrier of something or not. And moving forward, then you could say, okay, maybe I'm 18 years old and I'm single and I haven't met my partner yet, but knowing that I'm a carrier of some specific thing, that might be something to think about when I do find my partner someday and we do start to try for a family. But it's crazy that, you know, some of us don't catch this until we're already pregnant, and a lot of times in our second trimester or even after postmortem of a TFMR. And at that point, I just feel like it's really too late and we shouldn't have had to go through that. And I wish we all had that information to make informed decisions ahead of time.
Yeah, Callie, you've had two TFMRs. This is the thing. You've been through it twice now, and now you're having the genetic testing.
Yeah, so our first TFMR was last year for trisomy 21, so Down syndrome. And then the second one was for trisomy 14 mosaic. And that was at 35 weeks, the last one, because it had been misdiagnosed as something else. And we got to 35 weeks and another doctor looked at it and suggested that we do further investigative testing. So we had an amnio, which confirmed that it was trisomy 14 mosaic. So for us, the genetic testing, we felt it was really important to have, because I've got a healthy son, but we had two further pregnancies with different chromosomal issues.
Yeah.
We spoke to a genetic counselor who recommended that because we'd had two chromosomal issues, that it made sense to have more investigation done to see if there was a sort of a common denominator between the two.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, as it was being said, not knowing in advance, we found out through both of our pregnancies, through having amniocentesis, if that had been available before pregnancy, that is probably something we would have definitely taken advantage of rather than after the event, which is what we're waiting on now.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, my sort of feeling here, I mean, I'm Canadian, just in case anybody's wondering, listening to these podcasts and hasn't been able to place my accent. I'm Canadian. I grew up in Canada. I've lived here for nearly 20 years. And so I've experienced Canadian healthcare, which is different to American. We have a national health service. But I would say that it's a much more kind of, maybe lack of a better term, but sort of like proactive, like they will give you lots of things and tests and they'll do lots of stuff. My experience of UK is a bit more kind of, let's sit back and see what happens. That's my experience of healthcare in the UK, not necessarily maternity or, you know, what we're talking about with TFMR, but just in general. Sally, what would you say about that? Am I off my trolley about that? Or is that?
Necessarily. I suppose what I think you have to remember is that on the whole, you know, everybody who's coming to this podcast is talking from actual personal experience. Okay. Yeah. And when it's personal experience, that's 100% of you. When you look at the situation from a population point of view, it's not as much as you would imagine. It's still a lot, but it's not as much as you imagine. Mm. And so again, genetics is a very difficult thing to pinpoint. Of course, there are conditions that we know about which we can look on a gene. We know exactly where we're looking and everything. But to test everybody prior to having children, I'm not sure, certainly our system, the National Health Service,
wouldn't cope. Yeah.
They couldn't finance that.
No.
But also, I think that, you know, in the States even, with the differences in the different types of Medicare that's over there, there are going to be people who won't be able to access that. So still, it's never going to be an even offer.
Playing field.
No, it's not. Yeah. You know, and depending on where you're born, you know, who you know, whatever, how much money you've got, won't be the difference between people being able to do this. I don't think it's totally crazy to try and believe in the fact that the majority of pregnancies, if there's anything sort of pretty majorly going on with the early pregnancy side of things, most pregnancies will end themselves. Babies just stop growing. Now, that doesn't make it any less painful or anything, but normally that tends to be a structural problem.
Yeah.
So the heart hasn't come together properly or something like that. Whereas when you get these babies with these genetic conditions, even some of our testing doesn't always get everything. Because if you think about it, if you take from the placental tissue, you're taking from the placenta. The placenta and the baby, although the baby's using the placenta, it's not all baby's tissue. And sometimes it can give you an indication that there's something wrong and there isn't.
Yeah.
So it's not perfect. I mean, amnio is probably the next best one up because you're getting actual cells. Yeah. So you're able to get fetal cells and that's going to give you a much better DNA kind of situation.
So what I'm hearing is that we're dealing with an imperfect situation, really. We don't have all the answers. This is the thing. Kelly, is that answering your question? Does that give you what you need?
Yes. Yes. I mean, there was no kind of right or wrong answer to that question, but it was just kind of acknowledgement that it was, there wasn't something that we missed doing that we could have done or taken advantage of. But yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay. I really appreciate you coming on and asking your question. And thank you to Melanie also for your input on that from your experience. So I just wanted to, this was a listener question that came in. It's from Dee, and it kind of relates to our kind of aftercare. And hers was about who should be taking care of us afterwards. So I've also interpreted that with this 6-week postnatal care. You know, I've heard stories of women falling through the cracks with this and not having their 6-week checkup postnatally. So again, maybe we can start with Sally on this. And Jane, if you have any anecdotes or, you know, what you hear as well out there on the streets, that would be really helpful. So Sally, what about the 6-week postnatal care?
Okay, so the 6-week postnatal care is supposed to be normally with your GP.
Yes.
Okay, but most GPs will ask how you're doing, and that's kind of the checkup in a lot of cases. I mean, I'm not saying that to be negative, but that's kind of what it is. Mm. There's not a lot goes on unless there's something very obvious. But the care itself for families going through this is very, very fragmented, because depending on where you are, what hospital you're at, what their criteria are. So for instance, I mean, Hayley, you came through my hands only because I was asked to come and see you. And realistically, will that happen for every single person who's coming through that door? Not necessarily. Only those ones, A, who are willing to have me there, because that's quite a scary thing, because she's got a title of bereavement. Mm-hmm. So that kind of sounds like you've already made your decisions. So people tend to go, I don't really want to see a bereavement person. I haven't made my mind up yet.
That was me. But I didn't want to speak to you until I made a decision.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I kind of actually, I will say, I kind of wish that I had got you on board sooner.
Yeah. And the thing is that in our hospital, we don't have a gynae ward. So, of course, women who are coming through from 14 weeks onwards, if there is anything being planned, I've now got it written into our guideline that they will come to our bereavement suite on labour ward. However, I've had people who don't want to come. And then they're going to be on a general ward, a surgical ward, and they're not going to get the same treatment because the staff there should have better understanding, but they don't necessarily. And you could be sitting in a bed next to someone who's having a hysterectomy or someone who's got a bladder infection or whatever, whilst you deliver your baby in your bed. It's not ideal.
Yeah.
It's not ideal at all.
And so then presumably then the follow-up care is not going to be there, because you've now, you're on this ward and they'll go, right, you've delivered your baby, everything's fine. As far as physically, you're not bleeding out or anything. We don't need to do anything with you. So bye, you know, and that's it.
Yeah, you'll probably get a leaflet that tells you about SANS and ARC and all the rest of it. And normally your screening team, you know, the screening midwives really are fundamental to this, because they're the ones who will also provide you with the details of those organisations who can offer you support. And I think that that's really important. So places like Contact a Family or ARC or anyone who specialises, who has special knowledge, because a lot of these conditions, I mean, trisomy 14 is pretty rare.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be many people who have a lot of knowledge about it. Trisomy 21, we know a lot more about.
Yeah.
But some of them are so, you know, there might be 50 people in the whole world who've ever had this.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of information.
Yeah. And Jane, so what do you hear about this aftercare thing? What happens to a lot of women afterwards?
Yeah, it's inconsistency again, I'm afraid, that there are trusts and places that get it really right and do very well by women. But an awful lot, I have to say, do tend to feel that they have very good care in hospital. And then when they leave and the doors close behind them, it all falls away and they feel very left alone and lost. And there can be all sorts of reasons for that too. There are some women who, if they want to access a surgical termination, for example, will have to go into the independent sector to have their termination, kind of fall out of the loop of hospital care. The care between perhaps a local hospital and a specialist fetal medicine unit might not be joined up. So, it's not always very well coordinated. And although we do, I think, generally get mainly positive feedback about the care in hospital, it's another story once people leave.
Yeah, I have to say that's kind of our feedback that we get from people as well, that generally they say their hospital care very, very good. There may be the odd one or two people within that could have done better.
Sure.
And I always say and I'll say it here on the podcast, you should be writing to your hospital about your care that you receive for them, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. Because if you don't write to them, then the powers that be that run that hospital, not so much the healthcare providers, but the powers that be that run that hospital will never know that the care that they're providing is good or bad. And they will just keep doing what they do. And they will also not understand this whole thing that we were talking about before, about how bereavement care is integral and is important. And depending on that level of care that you've received, will have an impact on your future life and what that means for you as an individual. So yes, always, always, always write to your hospital and tell them about your experience.
Just to add to that, Hayley, we're always very willing to help people do that.
Okay.
You sometimes feel a bit onerous to put a letter to go together and where to send it. And we've fairly often helped people craft it so that, yes, you're talking about the things that didn't go well, but also mention the things that perhaps were handled better.
Yeah.
Because that often gets a better response ultimately.
Yeah, definitely. You know, and yeah, I think that's really good to know. I didn't know that, Jane. So that's really good to know that you help with that.
And one thing I would mention too is that also sometimes people can actually copy us in, ARC into the letter. And that sometimes focuses minds because it's then saying to the trust, other organisations are aware of this. Perhaps we ought to
think.
That's an excellent idea, Jane. Excellent.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's really good to know. Okay, so we're going to go to another listener. We're going to go to Janine. Are you ready? Yeah? Janine is joining us from California. So Janine has got a question around to do with regret is really what it is. So Janine, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. And I just wanted to start off by saying I really appreciate, you know, everything that you guys do. I think what I'm hearing a lot of today is a lack of information. And I think that was part of where some of my regret comes from, is I think having this lack of information at the time. And I'm fortunate now that I found, you know, this podcast, and I can echo what Jane had mentioned with the website Ending a Wanted Pregnancy. That was actually the first website that I found that I started to kind of gather this information. So it was really beneficial to have that. But I guess my question goes, just a little bit of backstory. So at our 20-week anatomy scan, we found out our baby boy was diagnosed with hypoplastic right heart syndrome and tricuspid atresia. And as it is, I think for many people, it's a very whirlwind process from there. And the doctor had asked, she presented me if I wanted to have a DNE or if I wanted labor and delivery. And I was so kind of blown away that she offered labor and delivery. I just kind of assumed that I had to have a DNE. And I remember my first thought was like, I can't deliver this baby. I haven't had my birthing classes. I don't even know how. How can I go through this? And I also just kind of thought that I couldn't imagine being awake when they took him away from me. And actually pretty shortly after, so I ended up opting for the DNA, and pretty shortly after, I immediately regretted that I didn't deliver him, and that I never got a chance to hold him, and I never got an opportunity to hug him. And I imagine, you know, as I'm finding through these websites, there's so many other people that have gone through similar experiences. So I guess my question is, I'm curious, you know, from your experiences, what have you heard of other people, you know, kind of having this similar regret? And it's been so difficult for me to cope with it. What are maybe some things that they've done to be able to cope with this regret that they have of never holding their baby?
Yeah, thanks, Janine. A really emotional question. This is hard. This is hard. Jane, let's start with you.
Sure. And first and foremost, Jane, I'm so sorry that obviously this is haunting you, the decision you made. And I've come across this before, I have to say. And there are no easy answers. I wish I could say this is what you can do to feel better immediately. You know that that's not possible. But what I can say is you described the catastrophic heart issues your baby boy had. You're thrown into that maelstrom of horror and grief and pain. And you're human. And all you can do is the best you can do to get through it, to cope. And I don't know whether you weren't given the right amount of time or help to work out which of the two methods was better for you, but you did what you could at the time. And I think it's really important to recognize that what you did at the time says nothing about the love you have for your baby boy. Nothing. because that's a given. You just had to go down the D&E route because at the time that's what you could cope with. The labour and the delivery fact felt too difficult. So that's one way to look at it. The other thing that sometimes I think can be unhelpful is that an awful lot of the accounts on social media and in forums are around labour and delivery and people being with their baby and talking about that and talking about how special it was. And that can be like a dagger in your heart to think, well, I'm a bad mum because I didn't do that for my baby boy. You're not a bad mum at all. You did what you could in those circumstances. And over time, I would hope that you will recognise that and reconcile yourself to that. Good therapist or counsellor, if it does prove really difficult, can be very helpful. But certainly in my experience, with the right kind of support, women do come through to an understanding that you're thrown into this utter nightmare as a human being and you do what you can.
Yeah. Thanks, Jane. And Sally, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm so sorry for you that you're feeling the way you do. And I think what Jane has said is absolutely right. At the time, you had to base everything on how you felt. And you can only go by what you understand at that moment. Without any further information, it's very, very difficult to make those decisions. And sometimes there isn't time for that further information. I believe that everybody should have all the information, but actually you can't always take it in anyway. I mean, I've had women who have come in to deliver babies. It hasn't happened very often, but whereby they've ended up having to have a surgical because the induction process didn't work at all. And so they're looking at it from the other aspect where they've talked through wanting to have, you know, the delivery and then ending up not having all of the things that you also haven't experienced. And that also, it can be very difficult. So it's not cut and dried. Not everybody who goes for a vaginal birth will have a vaginal birth. You know, I mean, with the surgical, then of course it's pretty much likely that it will be okay, it'll happen. But you're in such a difficult place. It's a rock and a hard place,
yeah,
that a person is in. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody to have to even think through it when you're already dealing with everything that someone's just told you about your baby, the baby you've been waiting to have, the baby that you love and still love and even now still love, you know, and always will do. You know, I do agree with Jane as well in terms of maybe looking at some counselling, but I think you need to be very careful about who you have counselling with, because they need to have knowledge about child loss. The loss of a baby is something so very, very different to a lot of counselling that is about bereavement. So the people that you seek must understand that.
Yeah.
They must have knowledge, because if they don't, they can do a lot of damage. Yeah.
And just one other thing I'd want to say, Janine, from other women that I've dealt with, is that sometimes it can feel, because of what happened, that you weren't able to honour your baby in the way perhaps now you think you might have wanted to. And there's nothing to stop you finding a way to do that now, yeah, finding something to do that's meaningful to you and your partner, to remember and to honour the baby boy you lost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point, that it's never too late. It's never too late to do something to connect and to honour them.
Well, I was just thinking, I mean, I quite often talk to people about writing letters to their children, telling them all about how they felt when they were in their tummy and all of these sort of things, just so that they can relive all of those wonderful feelings that they had when their baby was inside them, and telling him all about what you had planned and where you hoped he was going to be going and everything, because that keeps you connected with him. And you could do that from now until whenever, and seek people to talk about him. I'm sure you've given him a name. And if he's got a name, then asking people and saying, this is my son. He might not be here in my arms, but he's here in my heart and always will be. And I just need people to acknowledge his existence, because a lot of people also find that very difficult. Because I don't know if you went to the funeral or anything, or if everything was dealt with by the hospital or the centre that you went to. And that can be quite difficult, yeah, being able to say goodbye.
Yeah, I think that that's also an important, so if you haven't done a funeral or, you know, been there for that process, because we get listeners messaging us, sending us messages about this, that they didn't collect their baby's remains, that now they're regretting that they didn't. That I think is, you can still do something. And for goodness sakes, don't feel that because you don't actually have their remains, that that means you cannot do anything. And don't underestimate the power of still doing something, having some sort of ceremony for yourself and for them, how healing that can be. And you deserve that healing. You deserve it. So I really want that to sort of go in there for people, because you do deserve it. Janine, how's that sort of feeling? How are you feeling now?
I really appreciate everyone's responses. I think everything that all three of you said really kind of hit the nail on the head. On top of not delivering him, we didn't really have much consult before the DNA. And so it was literally, I think, moments before the dilators were being placed, they asked me if I wanted to take his remains. And again, I had no idea what that actually would look like. And I just imagined like leaving the hospital the next day, carrying this box with him. And I thought,
yeah,
I can't handle that. What am I supposed to do with that? And now again, another regret that I don't have his ashes, or I don't have his remains, and we didn't have a funeral. But I really do love the idea of that doesn't prevent us from still having some type of a memorial or honoring him. And I think everything that all three of you said really hit the nail on the head of a lot of, you know, there are some things where I feel guilty, like it means that I didn't love him, or I'm not a good mom because I didn't do these things. And your responses were all very genuine and beautiful, and I think really helped to make me feel better about those. But I know it's not that I'm a bad mom. We're all in this terrible situation, and you just do what you can in that moment, mm-hmm. and we can't beat ourselves up about it. So I really appreciate it. That was very helpful. Thank you.
Good. I'm really, really glad that you could come on here, and I know you were really nervous about coming on as well, so well done for doing it.
Can I just say one last thing? What I really want you to take on board is just be kind to yourself.
Yeah,
please be kind to yourself, because you've suffered enough, so be kind to yourself. And all you've said, the love you have and always will have for that baby boy, is a given.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, so we're going to go to our last listener, Melanie, who is also joining us from the States, but in New York on the other side. So, and you would have heard from Melanie earlier. She popped in to give us some of her thoughts on her experiences as well. So, Melanie.
Hi.
Lovely to have you here. What is your question?
First off, I just want to thank you to Haley and Catherine for creating this space and creating a dialogue surrounding TFMR, not just pregnancy loss or baby loss, but specifically termination for medical reasons. It means so much to so many of us. And it really is overwhelming to stand with a community of women that can profoundly relate to what it takes to make a heartbreaking choice and kind of navigating the grief and aftermath of that. My question is addressing what I guess was mentioned earlier as the inconsistencies in aftercare. You know, you receive this terrible diagnosis, and in a very short period of time, there's all these decisions that have to be made, and whether you're going to hospital or a clinic, you walk in and everything surrounding, you know, what you're going to do about your baby, and very little about what's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know that there's an emotional aspect, and there's bereavement groups dealing with how we feel and our grief, but not as much focus on the physical of what clinically and physically is going to happen to your body. And I was never given any leaflets. Even my discharge instructions were just, you know, watch for if you have an excessive fever or excessive bleeding, you know, come in or call. But there were a lot of physical hardships that I wasn't prepared for, or I didn't expect, that kind of added
to the trauma and served as an ongoing reminder of what should have been that wasn't. And I think 2 days after my termination for medical reasons for our daughter, I was 16 weeks, 5 days last year, and I came home and I was in the shower and my breast started to leak. And no one, I figured, you know, you had to be at least 35 weeks for something like that to happen. And I didn't anticipate that. So I guess my question for women everywhere that might be going through this is how soon you should expect milk production to come in, how soon after you leave hospital, and then is there anything we can do to kind of stop it or prevent it, or things that could lessen that trauma, because it was something no one warns you about, and then you're just standing in the shower crying, you have clogged milk ducts, your breasts are uneven, and you're just, it really is a physical reminder of the trauma, which then leads to the emotional. And if you guys have any suggestions on that.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I came to mind is like, you can't even go to anybody to say, or feel like you can't go to anybody to say, what do I do about this? Because it's not like you have a baby here, you know, that is requiring feeding. And so you don't have a group of mothers to sort of go to as well. Like, how do I deal with this?
Exactly.
Or a midwife or somebody who's coming in to help you. So yeah, Sally, what would you say?
So I think it's, I totally get where you're coming from. And I feel that we have to still maintain choices, yeah, even around milk production, because for some mothers to know that their breast milk comes in indicates to them that even though the situation was such that they've had to terminate the pregnancy, their body was ready to care for that child. So in some ways, that can be a very positive thing. So some people want to know that their bodies would have supported their baby at whatever gestation. And certainly every single woman who, from 14 weeks onwards, who comes through our hospital will be offered different choices. So either to allow the milk to come, there is a medication they can take to suppress milk production. And that's pretty much... it's incredibly effective. The only time I've had someone who has had any leaking following taking that was somebody who'd had twins. And I can only assume that the hormone levels needed to, you know, be dampened down quite a lot more because of that. And then, of course, there is the other option, which later on, if people wish to, but you have to be so far on in the pregnancy and you have to be accepted by certain milk banks. So you could actually provide milk for other babies who are in, you know, premature or sick in hospital. And for some families, that's what they want to do. So I believe it's very important that we offer all of those choices and we explain the difference in all of them.
Yeah, so it's in Melanie's case, she wasn't even told that this was possibly going to happen to her. And so that is the sort of trauma, really, isn't it? It's not so much that the milk came, it's the fact that you weren't expecting it, Melanie. That's what I heard.
And I would agree with that, because even I meet up with people in the hospital who say, why do I need to give this person this medication? She's like 15 weeks pregnant. And I'm like, because she'll produce milk.
Yeah.
Her body is ready at every stage to, you know, welcome a baby and feed it. So the majority of women, in fact, other than those who've actually got a medical condition that prevents them from producing milk, will produce milk.
Mm.
Yeah. From miscarriage, from termination, the milk will be there. Premature deliveries, because the body's ready.
Yeah. So it's sort of amazing what our bodies are capable of, really.
Yeah. And I think it's getting your head around that as well, Melanie. I think it's about thinking to yourself, yeah, it was a real shock that I didn't know that. And it really upset me. But also to take from that, that your body was ready for your little one. And it just didn't know the circumstances of why baby was born. But that it was ready for that baby.
Yeah.
And that could be, in a way, a better way to look at it. Because I'm sorry that they didn't tell you. They should have told you, because it's going to happen. And I don't know why some medical people just don't get it, that actually it will still happen. Yeah.
We did have, so we did our episode about surgical termination, actually, and it was Steph. And do you remember, Sally? Steph actually, so Steph's milk came in, and I believe she was warned. This is, I'm saying this now, I'm not sure if she was, but in any case, she drew a lot of comfort from it. So I think this is the thing about, we are all very different in this, and what we will draw comfort from, what will cause trauma. And I have to say, most of the time whenever I've spoken to people or I get their messages, most of that trauma is within the things that they felt they didn't know mm-hmm. or weren't told. So that's the real message here about, you know, having information. But your point, Sally and Jane, about being able to take the information in is also part of this. Melanie, how do you feel about that sort of answer?
I mean, it's one of those series of imperfect situations, and there's such a taboo around this subject that no one's talking about it. And if we were talking about it and we heard about it and we had the information, I don't think that there's really any wrong answers or wrong decisions, but it's about that knowledge so mm-hmm. that in a situation where you feel like you have very little agency or control, it's providing you as much as you can have, because you might not be able to change your baby's diagnosis or what's happening, and you might not get to keep them here, but with each little decision, you're just gaining a little bit more agency and control back by being informed and having that information. And this is one of the things that I wish I knew that it was going to happen and that I had a choice to either stop it or donate my milk if I was beyond a certain gestation, but nobody's really talking about it.
Yeah.
And I wish there was more consistency across medical providers, across standard of care in different locations. And speaking to some women that were receiving far less information than I had been given, and then certain women that had received far more information than I had been given. We all just have such different experiences, but I really appreciate your feedback and your answer.
Yeah. Jane, is there anything that you'd like to add to that about that specific question around, do you hear from women who have not been told these sorts of very specific things that can happen after a TFMR, the physical aspects?
We do. And I really appreciate Melanie's response there, because it just adds another dimension around not being in control and what's next.
Yeah.
What's the next awful thing that's going to happen and hit me? And seriously, it's so important that women are given information about the physical after effects. Bleeding's another one. Quite a few women come to us and say, I was shocked by how much I bled. And some doctors will talk about, oh, you'll bleed like it's a heavy period, but whose heavy period?
Yeah.
No, one woman's heavy period is another woman's light bleed. So it's these are not easy conversations, but it's really important that women are given some detail about the kind of things to expect and the range within that. Mm-hmm.
I feel like they also need the space. So it does come down to who is giving this information, or who is the person that's kind of standing in front of you as you're talking about what's happening to you, that person needs to be in a good place to receive this, which is, let's be honest, not all doctors, not all consultants are going to be able to do that. They might be very good doctors, but they're not particularly very great at the whole patient sort of emotional stuff. And that's the tricky thing. It'd be great if they all were, but they just aren't. And that's unfortunate. And it's really sucks if you're the one that's on the receiving end of that kind of, you know, you're the one that has the consultant that's not maybe great at that. And that's why there's places like ARC and other organizations that can help you through this, knowing what to ask and what's available. I wanted to end on, this is kind of a doozy of a question, but it kind of relates as well. So not just the medical staff, you know, who's maybe not giving it good information or good support, maybe. We've had a listener question from Linda about family support or lack thereof. So she has actually had very, very good hospital support, very good friend support, and very good family support, I think, on one side. So either her or her husband's side was particularly good. But the other side is ignoring them, basically. And she is finding this very hurtful. So her question was, you know, how to stop kind of almost like ruminating over the people who are not giving the support and to focus on the people who are. It's a very difficult question to ask. I'm sorry, Sally and Jane. But yeah, how can she sort of put them to one side and focus on the lots of support she is getting?
Ooh, it's very hard, because if these are family members that she or a woman is close to, you're not going to not be able to be angry that you haven't felt the warmth and support that you might expect. But it's not unusual. It's something we come across quite regularly. And I guess what we try to do with people is to help them manage their expectations about others' reactions, and particularly some of the people close to them, because in general, people don't deal with bereavement full stop very well. This is a particular, as Sally mentioned earlier, a particular kind of bereavement that is really complicated, that can sometimes touch people in certain ways. They identify with particular aspects of it that they might not have expected, which makes them back off. They just can't cope with it. And there might be all sorts of reasons for that reaction that you might not be party to. And even the person themselves, the family member themselves, might not consciously know why they've had this reaction. But it is what it is. And within this context, I guess for the bereaved parents, they've got to put themselves first and veer towards the places they are getting support.
Yeah,
it's not easy. I'm not pretending it's easy, because if it is, you know, your mum or your sister or somebody you're really close to, and this happens, obviously it's another devastating blow.
Yeah,
but you're not necessarily going to, when you need support, be able to sort that relationship. You need to pull away and veer to those people where you can get the kind of help and support you need.
Yeah. Sally, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, it made me think a little bit of when you sent out cards for Luna.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was very clear with you at the time, because you wanted her birth to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
And you said, well, you know, why hasn't anybody really contacted me? And I said, well, what did you do for Benjamin? And you were like, well, I mean, we sent out cards and everything. I said, so you could send out cards. But then I also pointed out to you that there comes a risk with that.
Mm.
And that risk is you don't know how other people are going to react to that. And you have to be prepared that some people will not acknowledge Luna.
Yeah.
Or anything to do with it, because it's not something that society talks about, you know?
Yeah.
It's very much a taboo subject. And I think that we do have to be realistic as well with people around us. And you put back to them what's their problem. It's not your problem.
Yeah.
It hurts. It hurts a lot. But it's about saying, okay, there is no point in pursuing this. Clearly something that's happened to them or something that they've heard or whatever, and that's their problem. I have enough to cope with right now. I just need to look after me. And me is the most important person. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. It made me think of, I heard this in the week, actually, that, you know, when people are not giving us what we need or what we want, it's not always necessarily because they just won't. Mm. It might be because they can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a very different thing. And actually, I took a lot of comfort in that. They just don't have the capacity. They can't. They don't know how. Yeah. For some reason, that really helped for me to hear that.
Yeah. I mean, society doesn't prepare us, because nobody really wants to talk about these. Are very, very taboo subjects. And, you know, it's a bit like children going to funerals. Yeah.
Yeah.
Should they go to funerals? Yes, I think they should, because actually that's their sibling.
Yeah.
And they have a right to say goodbye. And if we didn't cover it all up so much, there'd be a lot less problems for people to face. But also other people, aunts, uncles, even our own mothers, may have had a traumatic delivery or experienced, you know, a miscarriage or a termination, for which they were treated horrendously in a different generation. And they will have just been told to shut up and get on with it. And so then they can be quite kind of introverted onto that one, because it's like, well, no one was there for me, so it's no different.
Yeah.
So people just react as they need to react, but it's preparing yourself for the fact that not everybody is going to respond the way you expect them to, and that you just need to say, okay, clearly I can't bank on that person right now.
Yep. You kind of very quickly learn where you stand with everybody, and you know when the shit hits the fan who you can count on. And that's not always it's terrible that it's had to happen in this way, obviously, but I feel like it cuts a lot of the bullshit out of life in general. Great. Thank you so much. You know, Sally, Jane, Lucy, Melanie, Janine and Callie, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to all of our listeners who submitted questions. It's been great to do this episode, a bit of an experiment for us, but I hope that it's been enjoyable to listen to. Let us know by messaging us over on social media. Facebook and Instagram is @TimeToTalkTFMR and Twitter is @TalkTFMR. You can also subscribe to our podcast from Podbean or Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and it's a great way to make sure you get all of our new episodes as soon as they are published. So that's it for now. Thank you so much, and please take care of yourselves out there.